life at the thought of spending 8 days traveling upriver and 5 on the return, with no more than the bare necessities. Half a dozen cotton dresses, her toiletries, a pair of shoes for embarking and disembarking, her house slippers for the journey, and nothing else. Her lifetime dream. In January 1824, Commodore Johann Bernhard Elbers, the father of river navigation, had registered the first steamboat to sail the Magdalena River, a primitive old 40-horsepower wreck named Fidelity. More than a century later, 1/7th of July at 6 o'clock in the evening, Dr. Urbino Dasa and his wife accompanied Fermina Dasa as she boarded the boat that was to carry her on her first river voyage. It was the first vessel built in the local shipyards, and had been christened New Fidelity in memory of its glorious ancestor. Fermina Dasa could never believe that so significant a name for them both was indeed a historical coincidence, and not another conceit born of Florentino Ariza's chronic romanticism. In any case, unlike the other riverboats, ancient and modern, New Fidelity boasted a suite next to the captain's quarters that was spacious and comfortable. A sitting room with bamboo furniture covered in festive colors, a double bedroom decorated in Chinese motifs, a bathroom with tub and shower, a large enclosed observation deck with hanging ferns and an unobstructed view toward the front and both sides of the boat, and a silent cooling system that kept out external noises and maintained a climate of perpetual spring. These deluxe accommodations, known as the presidential suite, because 3 presidents of the republic had already made the trip in them, had no commercial purpose, but were reserved for high-ranking officials and very special guests. Florentino Ariza had ordered the suite built for that public purpose as soon as he was named president of the RCC. But his private conviction was that sooner or later, it was going to be the joyous refuge of his wedding trip with Fermina Dasa. When in fact the day arrived, she took possession of the presidential suite as its lady and mistress. The ship's captain honored Dr. Urbino Dasa and his wife and Florentino Ariza with champagne and smoked salmon. His name was Diego Samaritano. He wore a white linen uniform that was absolutely correct, from the tips of his boots to his cap with the RCC insignia embroidered in gold thread, and he possessed, in common with other river captains, the stoutness of a sabre-tree, a peremptory voice, and the manners of a Florentine cardinal. At 7 o'clock, the first departure warning was sounded, and Fermina Dasa felt it resonate with a sharp pain in her left ear. The night before, her dreams had been furrowed with evil omens that she did not dare to decipher. Very early in the morning, she had ordered the car to take her to the nearby seminary burial ground, which in those days was called La Manga Cemetery. And as she stood in front of his crypt, she made peace with her dead husband in a monologue in which she freely recounted all the just recriminations she had choked back. Then she told him the details of the trip, and said goodbye for now. She refused to tell anyone anything except that she was going away, which is what she had done whenever she had gone to Europe in order to avoid exhausting farewells. Despite all her travels, she felt as if this were her first trip, and as the day approached, her agitation increased. Once she was on board, she felt abandoned and sad, and she wanted to be alone to cry. When the final warning sounded, Dr. Urbino Dasa and his wife bade her an undramatic goodbye, and Florentino Ariza accompanied them to the gangplank. Dr. Urbino Dasa tried to stand aside so that Florentino Ariza could follow his wife, and only then did he realize that Florentino Ariza was also taking the trip. Dr. Urbino Dasa could not hide his confusion. "But we did not discuss this," he said. Florentino Ariza showed him the key to his cabin with too evident an intention, an ordinary cabin on the common deck. But to Dr. Urbino Dasa, this did not seem sufficient proof of innocence. He glanced at his wife in consternation, with the eyes of a drowning man looking for support, but her eyes were ice. She said in a very low, harsh voice,
"You too?"
Yes, he too, like his sister Ophelia, thought there was an age at which love began to be indecent. But he was able to recover in time, and he said goodbye to Florentino Arisa with a handshake that was more resigned than grateful. From the railing of the salon, Florentino Arisa watched them disembark. Just as he had hoped and wished, Dr. Urbino Daza and his wife turned to look at him before climbing into their automobile, and he waved his hand in farewell. They both responded in kind. He remained at the railing until the automobile disappeared in the dust of the freight yard, and then he went to his cabin to change into clothing more suitable for his first dinner on board in the captain's private dining room. It was a splendid evening, which Captain Diego Samaritano seasoned with succulent tales of his 40 years on the river. But Fermina Daza had to make an enormous effort to appear amused. Despite the fact that the final warning had been sounded at 8 o'clock, when visitors had been obliged to leave and the gangplank had been raised, the boat did not set sail until the captain had finished eating and gone up to the bridge to direct the operation. Fermina Daza and Florentino Arisa stayed at the railing, surrounded by noisy passengers who made bets on how well they could identify the lights in the city, until the boat sailed out of the bay, moved along invisible channels and through swamps spattered with the undulating lights of the fishermen, and at last took a deep breath in the open air of the great Magdalena River. Then the band burst into a popular tune. There was a joyous stampede of passengers, and in a mad rush, the dancing began. Fermina Daza preferred to take refuge in her cabin. She had not said a word for the entire evening, and Florentino Arisa allowed her to remain lost in her thoughts. He interrupted her only to say good night outside her cabin, but she was not tired, just a little chilly, and she suggested that they sit for a while on her private deck to watch the river. Florentino Arisa wheeled 2 wicker easy chairs to the railing, turned off the lights, placed a woolen shawl around her shoulders, and sat down beside her. With surprising skill, she rolled a cigarette from the little box of tobacco that he had brought her. She smoked it slowly, with the lid end inside her mouth, not speaking. And then she rolled another 2 and smoked them one right after the other. Sip by sip, Florentino Arisa drank 2 thermoses of mountain coffee. The lights of the city had disappeared over the horizon. Seen from the darkened deck in the light of a full moon, the smooth, silent river and the pasture land on either bank became a phosphorescent plain. From time to time, one could see a straw hut next to the great bonfires, signaling that wood for the ship's boilers was on sale. Florentino Arisa still had dim memories of the journey of his youth, and in dazzling flashes of lightning, the sight of the river called them back to life, as if they had happened yesterday. He recounted some of them to Fermina Daza, in the belief that this might animate her, but she sat smoking in another world. Florentino Arisa renounced his memories and left her alone with hers, and in the meantime, he rolled cigarettes and passed them to her already lit, until the box was empty. The music stopped after midnight. The voices of the passengers dispersed and broke into sleepy whispers, and 2 hearts, alone in the shadows on the deck, were beating in time to the breathing of the ship. After a long while, Florentino Arisa looked at Fermina Daza by the light of the river. She seemed ghostly, her sculptured profile softened by a tenuous blue light, and he realized that she was crying in silence. But instead of consoling her, or waiting until all her tears had been shed, which is what she wanted, he allowed panic to overcome him. "Do you want to be alone?" he asked. "If I did, I would not have told you to come in," she said. Then he reached out with 2 icy fingers in the darkness, felt for the other hand in the darkness, and found it waiting for him. Both were lucid enough to realize, at the same fleeting instant, that the hands made of old bones were not the hands they had imagined before touching. In the next moment, however, they were. She began to speak of her dead husband in the present tense, as if he were alive, and Florentino Arisa knew then that for her, too, the time had come to ask herself with dignity, with majesty, with an irrepressible desire to live, what she should do with the love that had been left behind without a master. Fermina Daza stopped smoking in order not to let go of the hand that was still in hers. She was lost in her longing to understand. She could not conceive of a husband better than hers had been, and yet when she recalled their life, she found more difficulties than pleasures. Too many mutual misunderstandings, useless arguments, unresolved angers. Suddenly, she sighed. It is incredible how one can be happy for so many years in the midst of so many squabbles, so many problems, damn it, and not really know if it was love or not. By the time she finished unburdening herself, someone had turned off the moon. The boat moved ahead at its steady pace, one foot in front of the other, an immense, watchful animal. Fermina Daza had returned from her longing. "Go now," she said. Florentino Arisa pressed her hand, bent toward her, and tried to kiss her on the cheek. But she refused in her hoarse, soft voice. "Not now," she said to him. "I smell like an old woman." She heard him leave in the darkness. She heard his steps on the stairs. She heard him cease to exist until the next day. Fermina Daza lit another cigarette, and as she smoked, she saw Dr. Juvenal Urbino in his immaculate linen suit, with his professional rigor, his dazzling charm, his official love. And he tipped his white hat in a gesture of farewell from another boat out of the past. "We men are the miserable slaves of prejudice," he had once said to her. "But when a woman decides to sleep with a man, there is no wall she will not scale, no fortress she will not destroy, no moral consideration she will not ignore at its very root." There is no God worth worrying about. Fermina Daza sat motionless until dawn, thinking about Florentino Arisa, not as the desolate sentinel in the little park of the Evangels, whose memory did not awaken even a spark of nostalgia in her, but as he was now, old and lame, but real, the man who had always been within reach and whom she could never acknowledge. As the breathing boat carried her toward the splendor of the day's first roses, all that she asked of God was that Florentino Arisa would know how to begin again the next day. He did. Fermina Daza instructed the steward to let her sleep as long as she wanted. And when she awoke, there was a vase on the night table with a fresh white rose, drops of dew still on it, as well as a letter from Florentino Arisa, with as many pages as he had written since his farewell to her. It was a calm letter that did not attempt to do more than express the state of mind that had held him captive since the previous night. It was as lyrical as the others, as rhetorical as all of them, but it had a foundation in reality. Fermina Daza read it with some embarrassment because of the shameless racing of her heart. It concluded with the request that she advise the steward when she was ready, for the captain was waiting on the bridge to show them the operation of the ship. She was ready at 11 o'clock, bathed and smelling of flower-scented soap, wearing a very simple widow's dress of gray etamine, and completely recovered from the night's turmoil. She ordered a sober breakfast from the steward, who was dressed in impeccable white and in the captain's personal service. But she did not send a message for anyone to come for her. She went up alone, dazzled by the cloudless sky, and she found Florentino Ariza talking to the captain on the bridge. He looked different to her, not only because she saw him now with other eyes, but because in reality he had changed. Instead of the funereal clothing he had worn all his life, he was dressed in comfortable white shoes, slacks, and a linen shirt with an open collar, short sleeves, and his monogram embroidered on the breast pocket. He also had on a white Scottish cap and removable dark lenses over his perpetual eyeglasses for myopia. It was evident that everything was being used for the first time and had been bought just for the trip, with the exception of the well-worn belt of dark brown leather, which Fermina Daza noticed at first glance as if it were a fly in the soup. Seeing him like this, dressed just for her in so patent a manner, she could not hold back the fiery blush that rose to her face. She was embarrassed when she greeted him, and he was more embarrassed by her embarrassment. The knowledge that they were behaving as if they were sweethearts was even more embarrassing. And the knowledge that they were both embarrassed embarrassed them so much that Captain Samaritano noticed it with a tremor of compassion. He extricated them from their difficulty by spending the next 2 hours explaining the controls and the general operation of the ship. They were sailing very slowly up a river without banks that meandered between arid sandbars stretching to the horizon. But unlike the troubled waters at the mouth of the river, these were slow and clear and gleamed like metal under the merciless sun. Fermina Daza had the impression that it was a delta filled with islands of sand.
"It is all the river we have left," said the captain.
Florentino Ariza, in fact, was surprised by the changes, and would be even more surprised the following day, when navigation became more difficult, and he realized that the Magdalena, father of waters, one of the great rivers of the world, was only an illusion of memory. Captain Samaritano explained to them how 50 years of uncontrolled deforestation had destroyed the river. The boilers of the riverboats had consumed the thick forest of colossal trees that had oppressed Florentino Ariza on his first voyage. Fermina Daza would not see the animals of her dreams. The hunters for skins from the tanneries in New Orleans had exterminated the alligators that, with yawning mouths, had played dead for hours on end in the gullies along the shore as they lay in wait for butterflies. The parrots with their shrieking and the monkeys with their lunatic screams had died out as the foliage was destroyed. The manatees with their great breasts that had nursed their young and wept on the banks in a forlorn woman's voice were an extinct species, annihilated by the armored bullets of hunters for sport. Captain Samaritano had an almost maternal affection for the manatees, because they seemed to him like ladies damned by some extravagant love, and he believed the truth of the legend that they were the only females in the animal kingdom that had no mates. He had always opposed shooting at them from the ship, which was the custom, despite the laws prohibiting it. Once a hunter from North Carolina, his papers in order, had disobeyed him, and with a well-aimed bullet from his Springfield rifle, had shattered the head of a manatee mother whose baby became frantic with grief as it wailed over the fallen body. The captain had the orphan brought on board so that he could care for it, and left the hunter behind on the deserted bank, next to the corpse of the murdered mother. He spent 6 months in prison as the result of diplomatic protests and almost lost his navigator's license, but he came out prepared to do it again, as often as the need arose. Still, that had been a historic episode. The orphaned manatee, which grew up and lived for many years in the rare animal zoo in San Nicolás de las Barrancas, was the last of its kind seen along the river.
"Each time I pass that bank," he said, "I pray to God that the gringo will board my ship so that I can leave him behind all over again."
Fermina Daza, who had felt no fondness for the captain, was so moved by the tender-hearted giant that from that morning on he occupied a privileged place in her heart. She was not wrong. The trip was just beginning, and she would have many occasions to realize that she had not been mistaken. Fermina Daza and Florentino Ariza remained on the bridge until it was time for lunch. It was served a short while after they passed the town of Calamar on the opposite shore, which just a few years before had celebrated a perpetual fiesta, and now was a ruined port with deserted streets. The only creature they saw from the boat was a woman dressed in white, signaling to them with a handkerchief. Fermina Daza could not understand why she was not picked up when she seemed so distressed, but the captain explained that she was the ghost of a drowned woman, whose deceptive signals were intended to lure ships off course into the dangerous whirlpools along the other bank. They passed so close that Fermina Daza saw her in sharp detail in the sunlight, and she had no doubt that she did not exist, but her face seemed familiar. It was a long, hot day. Fermina Daza returned to her cabin after lunch for her inevitable siesta. But she did not sleep well because of a pain in her ear, which became worse when the boat exchanged mandatory greetings with another RCC vessel as they passed each other a few leagues above Barranca Vieja. Florentino Ariza fell into instantaneous sleep in the main salon, where most of the passengers without cabins were sleeping as if it were midnight, and close to the spot where he had seen her disembark, he dreamed of Rosalba. She was traveling alone, wearing her Mompox costume from the last century, and it was she and not the child who slept in the wicker cage that hung from the ceiling. It was a dream at once so enigmatic and so amusing that he enjoyed it for the rest of the afternoon as he played dominoes with the captain and two of the passengers who were friends of his. It grew cooler as the sun went down, and the ship came back to life. The passengers seemed to emerge from a trance. They had just bathed and changed into fresh clothing, and they sat in the wicker armchairs in the salon waiting for supper, which was announced at exactly 5 o'clock by a waiter who walked the deck from one end to the other and rang a sacristan's bell to mocking applause. While they were eating, the band began to play fandangos, and the dancing continued until midnight. Fermina Daza did not care to eat because of the pain in her ear, and she watched as the first load of wood for the boilers was taken on from a bare gully, where there was nothing but stacked logs and a very old man who supervised the operation. There did not seem to be another person for many leagues around. For Fermina Daza, it was a long, tedious stop that would have been unthinkable on the ocean liners to Europe. And the heat was so intense that she could feel it even on her cooled observation deck. But when the boat weighed anchor again, there was a cool breeze, scented with the heart of the forest, and the music became more lively. In the town of Sitio Nuevo, there was only one light and only one window and only one house, and the port office did not signal either cargo or passengers, so the boat passed by without a greeting. Fermina Daza had spent the entire afternoon wondering what stratagems Florentino Ariza would use to see her without knocking at her cabin door, and by 8 o'clock she could no longer bear the longing to be with him. She went out into the passageway, hoping to meet him in what would seem a casual encounter, and she did not have to go very far. Florentino Ariza was sitting on a bench in the passageway, as silent and forlorn as he had been in the Park of the Evangels, and for over 2 hours he had been asking himself how he was going to see her. They both made the same gesture of surprise that they both knew was feigned, and together they strolled the first-class deck, crowded with young people, most of them boisterous students who, with some eagerness, were exhausting themselves in the final fling of their vacation. In the lounge, Florentino Ariza and Fermina Daza sat at the bar as if they were students themselves and drank bottled soft drinks. And suddenly she saw herself in a frightening situation. She said, "How awful!" Florentino Ariza asked her what she was thinking that caused her so much distress. "The poor old couple," she said. "The ones who were beaten to death in the boat." They both decided to turn in when the music stopped, after a long, untroubled conversation on the dark observation deck. There was no moon, the sky was cloudy, and on the horizon, flashes of lightning with no claps of thunder illuminated them for an instant. Florentino Arisa rolled cigarettes for her, but she did not smoke more than a few, for she was tormented by pain that would ease for a few moments and flare up again when the boat bellowed as it passed another ship or a sleeping village, or when it slowed to sound the depth of the river. He told her with what longing he had watched her at the poetic festival, on the balloon flight, on the acrobat's velocipede, with what longing he had waited all year for public festivals just so he could see her. She had often seen him as well, and she had never imagined that he was there only to see her. However, it was less than a year since she had read his letters and wondered how it was possible that he had never competed in the poetic festival. There was no doubt he would have won. Florentino Arisa lied to her. He wrote only for her, verses for her, and only he read them. Then it was she who reached for his hand in the darkness, and she did not find it waiting for her as she had waited for his the night before. Instead, she took him by surprise, and Florentino Arisa's heart froze. "How strange women are," he said. She burst into laughter, a deep laugh like a young dove's, and she thought again about the old couple in the boat. It was incised. The image would always pursue her. But that night she could bear it because she felt untroubled and calm, as she had few times in her life, free of all blame. She would have remained there until dawn, silent, with his hand perspiring ice into hers, but she could not endure the torment in her ear. So that when the music was over, and then the bustle of the ordinary passengers hanging their hammocks in the salon had ended, she realized that her pain was stronger than her desire to be with him. She knew that telling him about it would alleviate her suffering, but she did not, because she did not want to worry him. For now it seemed to her that she knew him as well as if she had lived with him all her life, and she thought him capable of ordering the boat back to port if that would relieve her pain. Florentino Arisa had foreseen how things would be that night, and he withdrew. At the door of her cabin, he tried to kiss her good night, but she offered him her left cheek. He insisted with labored breath, and she offered him her other cheek, with a coquettishness that he had not known when she was a schoolgirl. Then he insisted again, and she offered him her lips. She offered her lips with a profound trembling that she tried to suppress with the laugh she had forgotten after her wedding night. "My God," she said, "ships make me so crazy." Florentino Arisa shuddered. As she herself had said, she had the sour smell of old age. Still, as he walked to his cabin, making his way through the labyrinth of sleeping hammocks, he consoled himself with the thought that he must give off the same odor, except his was 4 years older, and she must have detected it on him with the same emotion. It was the smell of human fermentation, which he had perceived in his oldest lovers and they had detected in him. The widow Nazaret, who kept nothing to herself, had told him in a cruder way, "Now we stink like a henhouse." They tolerated each other because they were an even match, my odor against yours. On the other hand, he had often taken care of America Vicuña, whose diaper smell awakened maternal instincts in him. But he was disturbed at the idea that she had disliked his odor, the smell of a dirty old man. But all that belonged to the past. The important thing was that not since the afternoon when Aunt Escolastica left her missile on the counter in the telegraph office had Florentino Arisa felt the happiness he felt that night. So intense, it frightened him. At 5 o'clock he was beginning to doze off, when the ship's purser woke him in the port of Zambrano to hand him an urgent telegram. It was signed by Leona Cassiani and dated the previous day, and all its horror was contained in a single line. America Vicuña, dead yesterday, reasons unknown. At 11 o'clock in the morning, he learned the details from Leona Cassiani in a telegraphic conference, during which he himself operated the transmitting equipment for the first time since his years as a telegraph operator. America Vicuña, in the grip of mortal depression because she had failed her final examinations, had drunk a flask of laudanum stolen from the school infirmary. Florentino Ariza knew in the depths of his soul that the story was incomplete. But no. America Vicuña had left no explanatory note that would have allowed anyone to be blamed for her decision. The family, informed by Leona Cassiani, was arriving now from Puerto Padre, and the funeral would take place that afternoon at 5 o'clock. Florentino Ariza took a breath. The only thing he could do to stay alive was not to allow himself the anguish of that memory. He erased it from his mind, although from time to time in the years that were left to him, he would feel it revive, with no warning and for no reason, like the sudden pang of an old scar. The days that followed were hot and interminable. The river became muddy and narrow, and instead of the tangle of colossal trees that had astonished Florentino Ariza on his first voyage, there were calcinated flatlands, stripped of entire forests that had been devoured by the boilers of the riverboats, and the debris of godforsaken villages whose streets remained flooded even in the cruelest droughts. At night they were awakened not by the siren songs of manatees on the sandy banks, but by the nauseating stench of corpses floating down to the sea. For there were no more wars or epidemics, but the swollen bodies still floated by. The captain, for once, was solemn.
"We have orders to tell the passengers that they are accidental drowning victims."
Instead of the screeching of the parrots and the riotous noise of invisible monkeys, which at one time had intensified the stifling midday heat, all that was left was the vast silence of the ravaged land. There were so few places for taking on wood, and they were so far apart from each other, that by the fourth day of the trip, the new Fidelity had run out of fuel. She was stranded for almost a week while her crew searched bogs of ashes for the last scattered trees. There was no one else. The woodcutters had abandoned their trails, fleeing the ferocity of the lords of the earth, fleeing the invisible cholera, fleeing the larval wars that governments were bent on hiding with distracted decrees. In the meantime, the passengers in their boredom held swimming contests, organized hunting expeditions, and returned with live iguanas that they split open from top to bottom and sewed up again with baling needles after removing the clusters of soft, translucent eggs that they strung over the railings to dry. The poverty-stricken prostitutes from nearby villages followed in the path of the expeditions, improvised tents in the gullies along the shore, brought music and liquor with them, and caroused across the river from the stranded vessel. Long before he became president of the RCC, Florentino Ariza had received alarming reports on the state of the river, but he barely read them. He would calm his associates. "Don't worry. By the time the wood is gone, there will be boats fueled by oil." With his mind clouded by his passion for Fermina Daza, he never took the trouble to think about it, and by the time he realized the truth, there was nothing anyone could do except bring in a new river. Even in the days when the waters were at their best, the boats had to anchor at night, and then even the simple fact of being alive became unendurable. Most of the passengers, above all the Europeans, abandoned the pestilential stench of their cabins and spent the night walking the decks, brushing away all sorts of predatory creatures with the same towel they used to dry their incessant perspiration, and at dawn they were exhausted and swollen with bites. An English traveler at the beginning of the 19th century, referring to the journey by canoe and mule that could last as long as 50 days, had written, "This is one of the most miserable and uncomfortable pilgrimages that a human being can make." This had no longer been true during the first 80 years of steam navigation, and then it became true again forever when the alligators ate the last butterfly and the maternal manatees were gone. The parrots, the monkeys, the villages were gone. Everything was gone.
"There's no problem," the captain laughed. "In a few years, we'll ride the dry riverbed in luxury automobiles."
For the first 3 days, Fermina Daza and Florentino Ariza were protected by the soft springtime of the enclosed observation deck. But when the wood was rationed and the cooling system began to fail, the presidential suite became a steam bath. She survived the nights because of the river breeze that came in through the open windows, and she frightened off the mosquitoes with a towel because the insecticide bomb was useless when the boat was anchored. Her earache had become unbearable, and one morning when she awoke, it stopped suddenly and completely, like the sound of a smashed cicada. But she did not realize that she had lost the hearing in her left ear until that night when Florentino Ariza spoke to her on that side, and she had to turn her head to hear what he was saying. She did not tell anyone, for she was resigned to the fact that it was one of the many irremediable defects of old age. In spite of everything, the delay had been a providential accident for them. Florentino Ariza had once read, "Love becomes greater and nobler in calamity." The humidity in the presidential suite submerged them in an unreal lethargy in which it was easier to love without questions. They spent unimaginable hours holding hands in the armchairs by the railing. They exchanged unhurried kisses. They enjoyed the rapture of caresses without the pitfalls of impatience. On the third stupefying night, she waited for him with a bottle of anisette, which she used to drink in secret with Cousin Ildebranda's band, and later, after she was married and had children, behind closed doors with the friends from her borrowed world. She needed to be somewhat intoxicated in order not to think about her fate with too much lucidity. But Florentino Ariza thought it was to give herself courage for the final step. Encouraged by that illusion, he dared to explore her withered neck with his fingertips, her bosom, armored in metal stays, her hips with their decaying bones, her thighs with their aging veins. She accepted with pleasure, her eyes closed, but she did not tremble, and she smoked and drank at regular intervals. At last, when his caresses slid over her belly, she had enough anisette in her heart. "If we're going to do it, let's do it," she said. "But let's do it like grown-ups." She took him to the bedroom, and with the lights on, began to undress without false modesty. Florentino Ariza was on the bed, lying on his back and trying to regain control, once again not knowing what to do with the skin of the tiger he had slain. She said, "Don't look." He asked why, without taking his eyes off the ceiling. "Because you won't like it," she said. Then he looked at her and saw her naked to her waist, just as he had imagined her. Her shoulders were wrinkled, her breasts sagged, her ribs were covered by a flabby skin as pale and cold as a frog's. She covered her chest with the blouse she had just taken off, and she turned out the light. Then he sat up and began to undress in the darkness, throwing everything at her that he took off while she tossed it back, dying of laughter. They lay on their backs for a long time, he more and more perturbed as his intoxication left him, and she peaceful, almost without will, but praying to God that she would not laugh like a fool, as she always did when she overindulged in anisette. They talked to pass the time. They spoke of themselves, of their divergent lives, of the incredible coincidence of their lying naked in a dark cabin on a stranded boat when reason told them that they had time only for death. She had never heard of his having a woman, not even one, in that city where everything was known even before it happened. She spoke in a casual manner, and he replied without hesitation in a steady voice, "I've remained a virgin for you." She would not have believed it in any event, even if it had been true, because his love letters were composed of similar phrases whose meaning mattered less than their brilliance. But she liked the spirited way in which he said it. Florentino Ariza, for his part, suddenly asked himself what he would never have dared to ask himself before. What kind of secret life had she led outside of her marriage? Nothing would have surprised him, because he knew that women are just like men in their secret adventures. The same stratagems, the same sudden inspirations, the same betrayals without remorse. But he was wise not to ask the question. Once, when her relations with the church were already strained, her confessor had asked her out of the blue if she had ever been unfaithful to her husband, and she had stood up without responding, without concluding, without saying goodbye, and had never gone to confession again, with that confessor or with any other. But Florentino Ariza's prudence had an unexpected reward. She stretched out her hand in the darkness, caressed his belly, his flanks, his almost hairless pubis. She said, "You have skin like a baby's." Then she took the final step. She searched for him where he was not. She searched again without hope, and she found him unarmed. "It's dead," he said. It had happened to him sometimes, and he had learned to live with the phantom. Each time he had to learn again, as if it were the first time. He took her hand and laid it on his chest. Fermina Daza felt the old, untiring heart almost bursting through his skin, beating with the strength, the rapidity, the irregularity of an adolescence. He said, "Too much love is as bad for this as no love at all." But he said it without conviction. He was ashamed, furious with himself, longing for some reason to blame her for his failure. She knew it, and began to provoke his defenseless body with mock caresses, like a kitten delighting in cruelty, until he could no longer endure the martyrdom and he returned to his cabin. She thought about him until dawn, convinced at last of her love, and as the anisette left her in slow waves, she was invaded by the anguished fear that he was angry and would never return. But he returned the same day, refreshed and renewed, at the unusual hour of 11 o'clock, and he undressed in front of her with a certain ostentation. She was pleased to see him in the light just as she had imagined him in the darkness. An ageless man, with dark skin that was as shiny and tight as an opened umbrella. With no hair except for a few limp strands under his arms and at his groin. His guard was up, and she realized that he did not expose his weapon by accident, but displayed it as if it were a war trophy in order to give himself courage. He did not even give her time to take off the nightgown that she had put on when the dawn breeze began to blow, and his beginner's haste made her shiver with compassion. But that did not disturb her, because in such cases it was not easy to distinguish between compassion and love. When it was over, however, she felt empty. It was the first time she had made love in over 20 years. And she had been held back by her curiosity concerning how it would feel at her age after so long a respite. But he had not given her time to find out if her body loved him too. It had been hurried and sad, and she thought, "Now we've screwed up everything." But she was wrong. Despite the disappointment that each of them felt, despite his regret for his clumsiness and her remorse for the madness of the anisette, they were not apart for a moment in the days that followed. Captain Samaritano, who uncovered by instinct any secret that anyone wanted to keep on his ship, sent them a white rose every morning, had them serenaded with old waltzes from their day, had meals prepared for them with aphrodisiac ingredients as a joke. They did not try to make love again until much later, when the inspiration came to them without their looking for it. They were satisfied with the simple joy of being together. They would not have thought of leaving the cabin if the captain had not written them a note informing them that after lunch they would reach Golden La Dorada, the last port on the 11-day journey. From the cabin, Fermina Daza and Florentino Ariza saw the promontory of houses lit by a pale sun, and they thought they understood the reason for its name. But it seemed less evident to them when they felt the heat that steamed like a cauldron and saw the tar bubbling in the streets. Moreover, the boat did not dock there but on the opposite bank, where the terminal for the Santa Fe Railroad was located. They left their refuge as soon as the passengers disembarked. Fermina Daza breathed the good air of impunity in the empty salon, and from the gunwale they both watched a noisy crowd of people gathering their luggage in the cars of a train that looked like a toy. One would have thought they had come from Europe, above all the women, in their Nordic coats and hats from the last century that made no sense in the sweltering dusty heat. Some wore beautiful potato blossoms in their hair, but they had begun to wither in the heat. They had just come from the Andean plateau after a train trip through a dreamlike savanna, and they had not had time to change their clothes for the Caribbean. In the middle of the bustling market, a very old man with an inconsolable expression on his face was pulling chicks out of the pockets of his beggar's coat. He had appeared without warning, making his way through the crowd in a tattered overcoat that had belonged to someone much taller and heavier than he. He took off his hat, placed it brim up on the dock in case anyone wanted to throw him a coin, and began to empty his pockets of handfuls of pale baby chicks that seemed to proliferate in his fingers. In only a moment, the dock appeared to be carpeted with cheeping chicks running everywhere among hurried travelers who trampled them without realizing it. Fascinated by the marvelous spectacle that seemed to be performed in her honor, for she was the only person watching it, Fermina Daza did not notice when the passengers for the return trip began to come on board. The party was over. Among them she saw many faces she knew, some of them friends who until a short while ago had attended her in her grief, and she rushed to take refuge in her cabin. Florentino Ariza found her there, distraught. She would rather die than be seen on a pleasure trip by people she knew so soon after the death of her husband. Her preoccupation affected Florentino Ariza so much that he promised to think of some way to protect her rather than keeping her in the cabin. The idea came to him all at once as they were having supper in the private dining room. The captain was troubled by a problem he had wanted to discuss for a long time with Florentino Ariza, who always evaded him with his usual answer, "Leona Cassiani can handle those problems better than I can." This time, however, he listened to him. The fact was that the boats carried cargo upriver, but came back empty, while the opposite occurred with passengers. "And the advantage of cargo is that it pays more and eats nothing," he said. Fermina Daza, bored with the men's enervated discussion concerning the possibility of establishing differential fares, ate without will. But Florentino Ariza pursued the discussion to its end, and only then did he ask the question that the captain thought was the prelude to a solution. "And speaking hypothetically," he said, "would it be possible to make a trip without stopping? Without cargo or passengers? Without coming into any port? Without anything?" The captain said that it was possible, but only hypothetically. The RCC had business commitments that Florentino Ariza was more familiar with than he was. It had contracts for cargo, passengers, mail, and a great deal more, and most of them were unbreakable. The only thing that would allow them to bypass all that was a case of cholera on board. The ship would be quarantined. It would hoist the yellow flag and sail in a state of emergency. Captain Samaritano had needed to do just that on several occasions because of the many cases of cholera along the river, although later the health authorities had obliged the doctors to sign death certificates that called the cases common dysentery. Besides, many times in the history of the river, the yellow plague flag had been flown in order to evade taxes or to avoid picking up an undesirable passenger or to elude inopportune inspections. Florentino Arisa reached for Fermina Daza's hand under the table.
"Well then," he said, "let's do that."
The captain was taken by surprise, but then, with the instinct of an old fox, he saw everything clearly.
"I command on this ship, but you command us," he said. "So if you are serious, give me the order in writing and we will leave right now."
Florentino Arisa was serious, of course, and he signed the order. After all, everyone knew that the time of cholera had not ended, despite all the joyful statistics from the health officials. As for the ship, there was no problem. The little cargo they had taken on was transferred. They told the passengers there had been a mechanical failure, and early that morning they sent them on their way on a ship that belonged to another company. If such things were done for so many immoral, even contemptible reasons, Florentino Arisa could not see why it would not be legitimate to do them for love. All that the captain asked was that they stop in Puerto Nare to pick up someone who would accompany him on the voyage. He, too, had his secret heart. So the new Fidelity weighed anchor at dawn the next day, without cargo or passengers, and with the yellow cholera flag waving jubilantly from the mainmast. At dusk in Puerto Nare, they picked up a woman who was even taller and stouter than the captain, an uncommon beauty who needed only a beard to be hired by a circus. Her name was Zenaida Neves, but the captain called her "My Wild Woman." An old friend whom he would pick up in one port and leave in another, and who came on board followed by the winds of joy. In that sad place of death, where Florentino Arisa relived his memories of Rosalba when he saw the train from Envigado struggling to climb the old mule trail, there was an Amazonian downpour that would continue with very few pauses for the rest of the trip. But no one cared. The floating fiesta had its own roof. That night, as a personal contribution to the revelry, Fermina Daza went down to the galley amid the ovations of the crew and prepared a dish for everyone that she created and that Florentino Arisa christened Eggplant al Amor. During the day they played cards, ate until they were bursting, took gritty siestas that left them exhausted, and as soon as the sun was down, the orchestra began to play. And they had anisette with salmon until they could eat and drink no more. It was a rapid journey. The boat was light, and the currents favorable and even improved by the floods that rushed down from the headwaters, where it rained as much that week as it had during the entire voyage. Some villages fired charitable cannons for them to frighten away the cholera, and they expressed their gratitude with a mournful bellow. The ships they passed on the way, regardless of the company they belonged to, signaled their condolences. In the town of Magangay, where Mercedes was born, they took on enough wood for the rest of the trip. Fermina Daza was horrified when she heard the boat's horn with her good ear, but by the second day of anisette, she could hear better with both of them. She discovered that roses were more fragrant than before, that the birds sang at dawn much better than before, and that God had created a manatee and placed it on the bank at the Malameque just so it could awaken her. The captain heard it, had the boat change course, and at last they saw the enormous matron nursing the baby that she held in her arms. Neither Florentino nor Fermina was aware of how well they understood each other. She helped him to take his enemas, She got up before he did to brush the false teeth he kept in a glass while he slept, and she solved the problem of her misplaced spectacles, for she could use his for reading and mending. When she awoke one morning, she saw him sewing a button on his shirt in the darkness, and she hurried to do it for him before he could say the ritual phrase about needing two wives. On the other hand, the only thing she needed from him was that he cup a pain in her back. Florentino Arisa, for his part, began to revive old memories with a violin borrowed from the orchestra, and in half a day he could play the waltz of the crowned goddess for her, and he played it for hours until they forced him to stop. One night, for the first time in her life, Fermina Daza suddenly awoke choking on tears of sorrow, not of rage, at the memory of the old couple in the boat beaten to death by the boatman. On the other hand, the incessant rain did not affect her, and she thought too late that perhaps Paris was not as gloomy as it had seemed, that Santa Fe did not have so many funerals passing along the streets. The dream of other voyages with Florentino Arisa appeared on the horizon. Mad voyages, free of trunks, free of social commitments. Voyages of love. The night before their arrival, they had a grand party with paper garlands and colored lights. The weather cleared at nightfall. Holding each other very close, the captain and Zenaida danced the first boleros that were just beginning to break hearts in those days. Florentino Arisa dared to suggest to Fermina Daza that they dance their private waltz, but she refused. Nevertheless, she kept time with her head and her heels all night, and there was even a moment when she danced sitting down without realizing it, while the captain merged with his young wild woman in the shadows of the bolero. She drank so much anisette that she had to be helped up the stairs, and she suffered an attack of laughing until she cried, which alarmed everyone. However, when at last she recovered her self-possession in the perfumed oasis of her cabin, they made the tranquil, wholesome love of experienced grandparents, which she would keep as her best memory of that lunatic voyage. Contrary to what the captain and Zenaida supposed, they no longer felt like newlyweds, and even less like belated lovers. It was as if they had leapt over the arduous calvary of conjugal life and gone straight to the heart of love. They were together in silence like an old married couple wary of life, beyond the pitfalls of passion, beyond the brutal mockery of hope and the phantoms of disillusion. Beyond love. For they had lived together long enough to know that love was always love, any time and any place, but it was more solid the closer it came to death. They awoke at 6 o'clock. She had a headache scented with anisette, and her heart was stunned by the impression that Dr. Juvenal Urbino had come back, plumper and younger than when he had fallen from the tree, and that he was sitting in his rocking chair, waiting for her at the door of their house. She was, however, lucid enough to realize that this was the result not of the anisette, but of her imminent return. "It is going to be like dying," she said. Florentino Arisa was startled, because her words read a thought that had given him no peace since the beginning of the voyage home. Neither one could imagine being in any other home but the cabin, or eating in any other way but on the ship, or living any other life, for that would be alien to them forever. It was indeed like dying. He could not go back to sleep. He lay on his back in bed, his hands crossed behind his head. At a certain moment, the pangs of grief for America Vicuña made him twist with pain, and he could not hold off the truth any longer. He locked himself in the bathroom and cried, slowly, until his last tear was shed. Only then did he have the courage to admit to himself how much he had loved her. When they went up, already dressed for going ashore, the ship had left behind the narrow channels and marshes of the old Spanish passage, and was navigating around the wrecks of boats and the platforms of oil wells in the bay. A radiant Thursday was breaking over the golden domes of the city of the viceroys, but Fermina Vassa, standing at the railing, could not bear the pestilential stink of its glories, the arrogance of its bulwarks profaned by iguanas, the horror of real life. They did not say anything, but neither one felt capable of capitulating so easily. They found the captain in the dining room, in a disheveled condition that did not accord with his habitual neatness. He was unshaven, his eyes were bloodshot from lack of sleep, his clothing was still sweaty from the previous night, his speech was interrupted by belches of anisette. Senada was asleep. They were beginning to eat their breakfast in silence when a motor launch from the health department ordered them to stop the ship. The captain, standing on the bridge, shouted his answers to the questions put to him by the armed patrol. They wanted to know what kind of pestilence they carried on board, how many passengers there were, how many of them were sick, what possibility there was for new infections. The captain replied that they had only 3 passengers on board and all of them had cholera, but they were being kept in strict seclusion. Those who were to come on board in La Dorada and the 27 men of the crew had not had any contact with them. But the commander of the patrol was not satisfied, and he ordered them to leave the bay and wait in Las Mercedes Marsh until 2 o'clock in the afternoon, while the forms were prepared for placing the ship in quarantine. The captain let loose with a wagon driver's fart, and with a wave of his hand, he ordered the pilot to turn around and go back to the marshes. Fermina Daza and Florentino Ariza had heard everything from their table, but that did not seem to matter to the captain. He continued to eat in silence, and his bad humor was evident in the manner in which he breached the rules of etiquette that sustained the legendary reputation of the riverboat captains. He broke apart his 4 fried eggs with the tip of his knife, and he ate them with slices of green plantain, which he placed whole in his mouth and chewed with savage delight. Fermina Daza and Florentino Ariza looked at him without speaking, as if waiting on a school bench to hear their final grades. They had not exchanged a word during his conversation with the health patrol, nor did they have the slightest idea of what would become of their lives. But they both knew that the captain was thinking for them. They could see it in the throbbing of his temples. While he finished off his portion of eggs, the tray of fried plantains and the pot of café con leche, the ship left the bay with its boilers quiet, made its way along the channels through blankets of tarulla. The river lotus with purple blossoms and large heart-shaped leaves, and returned to the marshes. The water was iridescent with the universe of fishes floating on their sides, killed by the dynamite of stealthy fishermen, and all the birds of the earth and the water circled above them with metallic cries. The wind from the Caribbean blew in the windows, along with the racket made by the birds, and Fermina Daza felt in her blood the wild beating of her free will. To her right, the muddy, frugal estuary of the great Magdalena River spread out to the other side of the world. When there was nothing left to eat on the plates, the captain wiped his lips with a corner of the tablecloth and broke into indecent slang that ended once and for all the reputation for fine speech enjoyed by the riverboat captains. For he was not speaking to them or to anyone else, but was trying instead to come to terms with his own rage. His conclusion, after a string of barbaric curses, was that he could find no way out of the mess he had gotten into with the cholera flag. Florentino Ariza listened to him without blinking. Then he looked through the windows at the complete circle of the quadrant on the mariner's compass, the clear horizon, the December sky without a single cloud, the waters that could be navigated forever, and he said, "Let us keep going, 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 back to La Dorada." Fermina Daza shuddered, because she recognized his former voice, illuminated by the grace of the Holy Spirit, and she looked at the captain. He was their destiny. But the captain did not see her because he was stupefied by Florentino Arisa's tremendous powers of inspiration.
"Do you mean what you say?"
he asked.
"From the moment I was born," said Florentino Arisa, "I have never said anything I did not mean."
The captain looked at Fermina Daza and saw on her eyelashes the first glimmer of wintry frost. Then he looked at Florentino Arisa, his invincible power, his intrepid love, and he was overwhelmed by the belated suspicion that it is life, more than death, that has no limits.
"And how long do you think we can keep up this goddamn coming and going?" he asked.
Florentino Arisa had kept his answer ready for 53 years, 7 months, and 11 days and nights. "Forever," he said. This concludes the reading of Love in the Time of Cholera by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Copyright 1985 by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. English language translation by Edith Grossman. Copyright 1988 by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. This book was read by Armando Duran. This unabridged audiobook was recorded by arrangement with Alfred A. Knopf, an imprint of the Knopf Doubleday Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, and was produced in 2013 by Blackstone Audio Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.